This is the unwritten.
So, what's up, writers and readers? Today, you have joined the Unwritten. This is a Journey Writers Call, and this is gonna be a pretty dope episode. It's episode 2, and it's more of still a Get to Know Us episode. And we're really just gonna play this game of unpopular opinions. I think we've talked a little bit briefly before we started about just the fact that we have a couple, so there might not be a whole bunch of unpopular opinions, but we might unfold some more as we go through the episode. So I think we're gonna go ahead and start. I'm gonna go ahead and give it to Susan, since she was giving some intriguing, she made me intrigued. I'm interested. So what's your first unpopular opinion, Susan?
I'll start with my personal one. So everybody, this is Susan. And my first one is, it involves like book to movie adaptations. And my unpopular opinion, or at least I think it's unpopular, is watching the movie before I read the book does not ruin the book for me. So, because I know that there's, you know, a lot of people will say, you know, you need to read the book before you see the movie. And I have done that. And I do still enjoy the movie after reading the book. But my first memory that I have of really kind of getting into reading was reading the first ever Percy Jackson book, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. And what got me to read the book was actually watching the movie. But after reading the book, while I was reading it, I realized how different the movie script was written compared to the book itself. And after reading the book, I was like, wow, that movie was actually kind of terrible compared to the book in terms of just like following the actual story. The movie itself on its own, I thought was good, but it did not match the plot of the book at all. Now, when they made the sequel movie to Lightning Thief, it was Percy Jackson and Sea Monsters, I believe, they did follow the book a lot more closely, which was nice. So that's my first unpopular opinion.
Susan, it's interesting that you say that, because two of my unpopular opinions actually have to do with like book to movie adaptations. Mm-hmm. And so one of them is actually, I don't believe that movie adaptations need to be like directly mirrored from like the plot of the book.
Yes.
I used to think that. I was one of those people that actually read the Certain Reasons Why book before it became a Netflix series.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at first I was like, oh, like I don't like it. It's gone so far away from it. But I think when you understand like different mediums and like, you know, you only have a certain amount of time to like, you know, get the point across in a movie versus in a book, you can take a little bit longer to flesh out those ideas. And it can just be appealing to different audiences, right? So let's say someone really enjoyed the book and then a different group of people really enjoyed the movie. I think that that's totally fair, you know? So that was actually one of mine. And then the other one that was related to that was that not every best-selling book needs a movie adaptation, right?
Like, yes.
I completely agree.
No, I completely agree with you on those, because going back to your first one, what was your first one again?
Movie adaptations don't have to directly mirror the plot of the book.
Yes, because similar to Percy Jackson, the movie itself was really good. I love the movie. But I was like, well, if you're comparing it to the book, well, then the movie plot was actually completely different. But I agree, especially after taking a screenwriting class and having to take a book and shave it down to fit a 2.5 hour time frame can be really hard. I don't know if anyone has gone to see Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes recently.
I won't give
any spoilers for you, Marissa, but there were some things in the book that were left out specifically just because of the rating of it, because there were things in the book that were rated R, but because the movie was rated PG-13, they had to leave them out. And I also feel like you can like the movies for different reasons. Like, you can like it because your favorite actor's in it, or because you love the way that a character is being portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think that there are many different reasons to like a movie adaptation versus the book. But I do understand where some people come from when they say, well, it's like the movie is the tip of the iceberg and the book is like the rest of the iceberg underneath the water.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah, it's...
I think for authors that have that opportunity to, you know, transform their books into movies, it's an opportunity for them to be like, oh, or for readers or viewers to be like, oh, I really enjoyed this. Let me see what the book is like, right? So I think it's multi-purposeful in the fact that, like, you're getting the viewers from the movie, but then they might be interested in like actually reading the book on the back end as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's what kind of got me reading into the Percy Jackson series. Because after I read the first book and loved it, I was like, okay, I need to read the rest of them. Because so the movie's what got me into it. Because I like the movie so much, I thought, well, if I like the movie, I must love the book, and I did. But the other thing is, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I was watching a bunch of stuff about the song Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. I was watching this video, and I feel like someone had done their research, and they found out that when Suzanne Collins was writing Ballads of Songbirds and Snakes, she was writing the book specifically to be turned into a movie, so she had that mindset. Which I think is really interesting, because a lot of people have argued that it could have easily been turned into like a mini series because the book is actually kind of long, or it could have been like a two-parter movie, because everyone argues that Mockingjay should have just been one movie and Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes should have been two. But I just remember hearing that and reading that in the comment section that she actually wrote it with the intention of it being turned into a movie, because by the time that she had started writing it, I think the first Hunger Games movie had come out. So obviously it was going to continue. So I just thought that was a really interesting part, because obviously there were things that were written in the book that weren't in the movie, partly because of the rating of the movie, and then also because of time. But a lot of people that have read the book and then watched the movie said that it was done really well for a book to movie adaptation. So that was another point I wanted to make in that hot take. But kind of going into another one, this one gets into a little bit more literary, but I have read The Great Gatsby. It's just been many, many years. But someone on Reddit had posted, Great Gatsby is a perfect book for teaching 14-year-olds about metaphors and symbolism. It is, however, a terrible pick for great American novel when compared with the other books in contention for that title. It seems both incredibly simple and limited in its scope. Have you guys read The Great Gatsby?
I read it
in high school.
You read it in high school. Do you guys, I don't know, I when it comes to the great American novel or like literature in general, and this kind of made me think about reading in general, do you think to be into like reading and, you know, getting into symbolism and metaphors, do you think you have to be interested in, like, this, you know, the types of stories you're going to read in English Lit in college and high school?
No.
I don't think so either, because it's just, I've tried to get into, like, Great Gatsby and some of the older, I don't even know what to properly call it, just the older literature. The
literary canon?
Yeah.
Yeah, the literary canon.
Yeah, the literary canon. I just can't get into those stories. I did like Frankenstein when I was in college because I did have to read that, but I don't know. It's just not an area of storytelling that I have gotten into. I don't know if it's because it was just written in a different time and I prefer more current things, but I just don't care for those stories too much.
I was trying to explain something like this to my grandmother the other day about, like, I think my biggest thing about the literary canon is that I remember taking in graduate school, I took a writers of color class, and a lot of those books were supposed to make up the literary canon, but they were writers of color, you know, that just so happened to slip into literary canon. The literary canon is mostly made up of white male writers, right? And those books that are popular, that are by people of color, are the ones that have been accepted by the white majority and are popularized by the white majority. And so a lot of times those books end up being, while truthful in terms of their scope and their presentation of a community of people of color, it's not showing the full spectrum of what it is to be a person of color. Whether you're in America or another country, a lot of times it's kind of showing this one little aspect. of those people. So I think when I was in this particular class, there was a book we renewed about Toni Morrison, and this professor, it was talking about a Japanese professor. She was not born in America. She was born in Japan, but she'd come over to teach here, and she made it her a point to bring all sorts of different writers into the scope. We even had a Native American writer, all kinds of writers. But she made a point of bringing all these different writers in. And I thought, what was so hard for me to do in that class, first of all, I hate taking literary classes, but what was hard for me was having to read morbid piece after morbid piece after morbid piece. Like, I remember sitting in the class and being like, I think I ended up saying in class, like, are we ever gonna read something that's like positive? Like, I done read about rape after rape and loss after loss. Can we get a break? And I think that makes up a large part of the literary canon, whether we're talking about people, writers of color, or we're talking about white people. Like, I think that makes up a large part of it. But then also, there's a type of transition. The point of the literary canon is that it makes up so many social structures. It makes up a big part of how we function in our everyday life. And at some point, you got to transition out of that old school. You have to transition away from those older books, those classics. You got to transition from Great Gatsby and Pride and Prejudice, even if that's even considered part of literary canon in America. You have to transition out of that to show the next time period. So I don't get really messed up about that part, because I'm a part of the community, the group, that's the next generation of writers that's trying to reflect my surroundings and the era that I live in. And we kind of got into this in the last episode, but some of that also means changing technique and changing, like, you know, style, and which, I don't know, that just means that there's such a different tone in the workshop room. But I think at the end of it all, it's no big deal, because at some point you got to change it. It has to change, and the literary canon has to move on.
I feel like eventually some books would kind of, I don't want to say replace, but kind of take position of some books that are in the literary canon, like stuff more current. Like, I think about when my mom was, you know, working in the library, and she was in charge of what books English teachers would be teaching in their class. And so she kind of got to the point where it's like, To Kill a Mockingbird, it's a great book, it's good to learn from, but it's also very dated in terms of, like, students today will read it, but they can't exactly relate to it. And so instead of, like, To Kill a Mockingbird, they started putting in The Hate U Give as the class novel that they would read, because that's more current to today, and things like that. So I'll be interested to see, because obviously classics will always be classics, but I think that there will be some that'll kind of be added to that category, in a sense, of the literary canon, maybe. But kind of what you were talking about brought me to my next hot take that I discovered. And this will definitely be something for Marissa, you and Kate to respond to, because I feel like you kind of got into it when you were talking about your master's degree, but I found something, and I'll just read it. It was something that someone had posted on the Hot Takes Reddit thread for literary things, and it says, "The supremacy of MFA programs is destroying the diversity of American contemporary fiction. These programs churn out people who will write the same way, following the same rules, and it becomes not only predictable, but tedious and sometimes downright offensive because of the largely rich white bubble these works are produced in. It's like a bad game of telephone with everyone writing the same book. If I pick up a hyped literary book, there's a 50% chance I'll get no pleasure out of reading it. 20% I'll throw it across the room at some point. We need to experiment in outsider literature to push the envelope and create touchstone literature instead of a parade of hip, marketable, and forgettable novels that add nothing to the conversation." I know it's a loaded hot take that someone wrote, but I read that because it specifically talked about MFA programs, and you both have your MFA. And so I'm just curious because you guys went to different programs. What's your take on that? Because I personally don't have one because I wasn't in an MFA program, but when it talked about churning out the same thing, given I haven't read a whole lot lately, but I feel like just based on cover art that I see,
Oh, God.
a lot of it is it's
The
very
same.
similar, and that may just come from the publisher has an art style because they have a hired graphic designer. But it kind of made me think. I feel like there are kind of a lot of similar takes on stories, which I get, you can get inspiration from others, but I wanted to know your opinion on this comment just because it was about MFAs and the programs and what I guess people take away from them.
What do you think, Kate?
I probably would say I would agree to an extent. Because honestly, I say if you're going to grad school, I feel like you're going just because you just kind of want to better yourself at that point. I feel like you really don't even need a master's, honestly, for a lot of things that you can do. A bachelor's is okay. But for me, I feel like I went and got my MFA because I wanted to improve my skills, I guess, like as far as writing goes. But I mean, sometimes I'm not gonna lie, I feel like some of them classes was like a cash grab, I ain't gonna lie. Because like a lot of it was like if I'm being fully transparent, my MFA was probably the easiest MFA I could have got. Like every class I got an A. And my GPA when I graduated was a 4.0 because it was that easy. Because the classes were like literally the same as my classes that I had took in undergrad. So I felt like the program probably could have done some better revising. And now I will say my teachers, I thought they picked good stories for us to read and stuff. And I feel like they didn't stick to like the typical stories we were able to like. Read stories that are pretty good, current up with the times and stuff like that. But for me, with my program, I think they could have done a better job at, I guess, like organizing it and structuring it. Like, for one, it didn't need to be a 3-year program, it should have just been a 2-year program. I don't know. Marissa, what about you?
I think I think people forget you. First of all, you have a choice of whether you go to get MFA. First, there are a lot of people that don't get in their first time, their second time, or their 45th time. And I remember I had a professor who came to me and a couple of years before I was about to finish my bachelor's degree, and she kind of was like, "Marissa, you have to go to a master's program." And I could have been like, "I ain't sure about that, Dr. Venus Lice. Anybody trying to do that?" But she was like, "You have to," and she was saying, "You need to go to a different state because the whole point of a master's program is to go and explore and expand." And so I went to a whole different state to get my master's. And what I appreciated that it was that you have a choice, right? Not just to get the master's program, but also you have a choice in your style and what you choose. That's the point of the program. It's for you to discover what your style and your technique is. So when you go to a professor and you're taking every technique they give you, and you're taking every style they give you, and you're applying everything they tell, they're just giving you suggestions. You don't have to take those suggestions. I had a professor who everybody in it feels like everybody in the country knows, Richard Bowles. She probably wouldn't like me saying that he was my professor because I sure was like going against all his advice most of the time. But he was constantly advising me to do different things. I think one big thing we didn't butt heads about it because I really didn't think much about it when he told me to do it. But I'm the type of writer that I'm very precise about dialogue. I try to make the dialogue as realistic as I possibly can. And that'll be something that he'll be like, "Don't do that. You don't need to do that because when the readers are reading, you don't want to get them so caught up in the dialogue that they forget where they are and that sort of thing." And that's exactly what I wanted to do as a writer, right? I wanted to draw readers in so much they feel like they're in the shoes of those characters. And that's just my style. right? So when it comes to churning out the same kind of writers and the same style of writers, it kind of, for me, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the literary canon. The problem at this point is, like, if you go into an MFA program, you can end up coming out with the same writers, one on top of the other, because they're all coming from the same program, and all the programs are combined and trying to teach each other the same techniques and same styles. But then the literary canon doesn't change. And the danger, too, at the same time with the literary canon changing is kind of what we talked about in the last episode, when we talked about books that are moving from plot point to plot point. Once you change that style, you change that technique, suddenly all that was cool and great about the classics, that detail, that drawing you in, that's gone, because now people just are quick to get to the point of the book, right? So it really comes down to every individual writer making a decision about what kind of style and technique they want to use. What is their point? What do they care about when they're writing? What do you want these people to come out of this book feeling? And that's an individual choice. And what I appreciate is that even though we can get the same stories like 45 different times, I appreciate something Richard said one time. I had a classmate from Shanghai who, she wanted to write Chinese mysteries. And she said, you know, I'm worried that I'm gonna write something that somebody else has already written. And he said, you're gonna write something somebody else has already written. The point is that you haven't written it yet. You haven't written whatever you need to write. You're gonna write something, there is no new idea, ever. You're gonna write something somebody else has already written. The point is you gotta write it for yourself. You gotta wanna see it on the page. And it's kind of reminding me of something Toni Morrison said. I think somebody asked her in an interview before, like, why do you write the characters you write? She just said, you know, I just wanted to see them on the page. I just wanted to see them come alive. And that has to be kind of like how you go about whether you're going to go ahead and get an MFA and expanding your technique and expanding your style. Like, you kind of have to go into it thinking about what you want. That's the cool thing about being a writer. You could be selfish. You don't have to worry about everybody else. Mm-hmm. So that's how I feel about that.
Okay. Well, I guess kind of going in, that was a really good response, so thank you. Going into my third, just because that way we can get to everybody else too, is, and this is a hot take that I also agree with because I've done this. If you don't like a book, you don't have to finish it. The whole it gets better later on is a symptom of poor craft and a terrible reason to be miserable for 100+ pages. Yeah. Okay, I have started books and I have not finished them. I don't think it's because of the writing or, like, it has nothing to do with the author or how they wrote the book. I'm just not interested in the story at that time. I remember I picked up this book, this was years ago, but it was about this mystery of, I guess not really a mystery, but this girl had started going to high school. She had moved and was living with a foster family because her dad is basically a murderer who got caught and he escaped from jail is where the book picks up in the beginning. And so basically she's trying to, like, be a teenager, live her life, but without everybody knowing that she is the daughter of this notorious murderer in North or South Carolina. And so she tries to keep that a secret, and then all of a sudden this news breaks out that her father has escaped from prison. And so, and the book is really interesting in itself, and it has, like, flashbacks of when she was a child, and her father would give her these gifts, but they were gifts from the women, like, he murdered, and things like that. And so, I mean, the concept and the book was very good, but I just couldn't get into it. I ended up just putting it down because there would be such a large time break between when I would read it and then when I would pick it up again that it just, the pacing of it for me just wasn't there. So I ended up putting it down, and honestly I thought, you know what, I'll probably pick this up again at some point. I never did. I think I ended up giving it away because I had to, like, clean out my bookshelf at one point, but I've done that before. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, what are your thoughts on it gets better later on, but you just put it down anyway.
I want to see if anybody else got a response before I have a response.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm a huge proponent of quitting. Like, whatever doesn't serve you, like, do away with it, which I need to work on. But I would agree with that. I think, you know, the whole purpose of literature is, like, entertainment or, like, you know, expanding your world's view. And if it's not serving you, then bye-bye. You know, I think I feel the same way about, like, Netflix shows. Some people are like, oh, you know, you just have to get past the first season. I'm like, no, I'm not wasting my past the first season to get to this one specific plot. So I would agree. I think, yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, I agree as well.
Yeah, I think I do agree. It's so funny because I didn't tell y'all, but my article for Publishers Weekly was published, like, I don't know, a couple weeks ago. It was published, I don't know. And something I said in it was, I was talking about reading slumps. I kind of get the same advice that I gave in the podcast episode, but one big point I made was like, just drop the book. Like, it's okay. Like, ain't nobody gonna kill you for dropping that book. And I think, and I say that, but it's because I've worked really hard at it. I'm the type of person that will not drop something just so that I can like say I finished it. So that I can, you know, just be like, I finished it. And sometimes I don't, like, especially when I'm watching K-dramas, for example, I'm the type to, like, push and push, push and push through a show. Just to be like, I got through it, like. And I think that comes from, like, wanting to have an interest in something, wanting to feel a part of a community. I think for a long time that was, like, my biggest thing was, like, I wanted to be a part of whatever was going on. Until I realized that, like, it's okay to not always be a part of like whatever the conversation is and not know what's going on. And so as of late, over the past couple of years, I've been the type to be like, shoot, if I don't like it, I just ain't gonna watch it. I'm not even gonna give it a chance, or I'm not even gonna pick it up and read it. And that has been very relieving. It's a relief. So I think it's a good way to break up that big old bowl of like options you have. Like, and once you start like getting rid of stuff you're not interested in, it's like, God, thank you, because I really wasn't down for any of that. But then also, I think I saw a TikTok about, there was this girl, she's an English book talker, and she mentioned one book series that everybody was saying, you know, you gotta read like the first three books to get to the interesting part of the series. And she was like, ain't no way I'm gonna read three books just to get to the most interesting book. Y'all are all crazy. And I was like, I don't even know why anybody would tell somebody to read the first three books. Like, throw them books in the trash. The first three ain't good. It's just gonna have to be that way. So I'm definitely not the type to read the first three or the first, even the, I'm the type to give up in the first 10 minutes of reading something if I don't like it. Or watching something if I don't like it. I'll just give up. And I'm kind of like Susan, and there's times that like I'll pick something up, read it or watch it, and I'm trying to give it a chance, so I'll let it go for too long of a time. The time will pass for too long, and then I'll pick it up again, and I'll realize I was never really interested in the first place. So I might as well just give it up. And that's okay.
Yeah, it's, and I'm like that with a lot of shows too, where I'll watch it like, Steven will try to get me to watch a show, and he's like, you just need to watch the first, like, after the first episode. And I'm like, okay, well, I can watch one episode. And then usually by the end of that episode, I know if I want to continue the series or not. And sometimes it just depends on what I'm interested in at the time. Like, 2 months, like, 6 months from now, the show that I did not want to watch last week after the first episode, I very well may want to watch the entire series. So I think it also just depends on what your interests are at the time.
Yeah. And like, I think my biggest thing is usually what's consuming my, like, what is consuming my mental space at that point? Not just like, am I interested? Because I might even be interested in it, but not have the energy to process all that I need to process while I'm reading it or while I'm watching it. So I'll just be like, I'll stop. And then it might be 2 years from now, but I'll pick that mug up again. And be like, oh, okay, yeah, I was totally interested in it. I just needed this mental space for it.
Mm-hmm. So what are y'all's hot takes? Those were mine, personal and then ones that I also discovered.
One of mine, this might be a little polarizing, not sure, but I don't think that, like, sex scenes should be set in, like, high school or, like, a lot.
Oh, I completely agree. I completely agree. I completely agree. Because they're in high school. Or, like, there are TV shows that show high school kids drinking like it's a normal thing. And I'm like, I understand that this does happen, but I don't think that it's something that should be promoted.
And I think that there's a huge gap of, like, 21 to 25, like, literature that could be utilized with that, with the same type of plot, same type of thing. But, like, having these things set in high school and, like, teenagers is a little weird and kind of, like, borderline, like, pedophilia. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Yeah. So, like, I could never get into, like, Euphoria for that exact reason.
No.
I'm older, but in my mind, I'm like, these are teenagers having sex on TV. I don't want to be a part of it, you know? So I feel like the same, I feel the same in literature. I feel like there's a gap that needs to be filled with older, younger adults. And we don't, leave the teenagers alone. Like, again, I get that it happens, but yeah.
It's, and I feel like if someone wants to make a story about that, then, like, set it in college or they're in grad school, or, like, make them older so it's not so, because, like, there's a lot of stuff that goes around about, like, shows like Euphoria, because I tried to watch one episode of it just out of, like, just pure curiosity. I got a physical headache. I couldn't watch it. So I turned it off. And so, because I feel like if I'm going to talk about something or have an opinion about it, I need to watch it. And I couldn't even do that. So, but no, that's something I completely agree with.
Me too. What'd you think, Kate?
Yeah, I agree too. I just find it kind of weird that a lot of people feel like a lot of, because I mean, I read and write a lot of YA, so I feel like a lot of it is always set in high school. And I feel like they always leave out the college experience, they like gap, that weird gap that they never want to write about.
Yes.
And like this one, what was that one book I thought did a good job of it? I just recently read it not too long ago. I forgot it. The Summer I Turned Pretty. I don't know if you guys have ever read that book before.
That's right.
Oh, I just said I've heard of it, but I haven't read it. Or I know it's a show too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a show.
I've listened to the audiobook and I've seen the show.
I've never watched the show, but I have read the book yet. I said I was going to watch the show, but to be honest with you, it takes me forever to watch shows nowadays anyway. But yeah, I agree. It's just, like, they need to, like, start writing and, like, fill in that weird gap. Because, like, there's nothing wrong with writing about college. And to be honest with you, I feel like college is more exciting to read about than high school.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why they're just so scared to write that. Like,
well, okay, so this is my hot take on that, because there's a hot take connected to that. Okay,
yes. So tell me the attraction, please.
So when it comes to, so that genre will be called New Adult, and we grew up with New Adult. We grew up with Colleen Hoover, Jennifer L. Armentrout. Like, we grew up with those writers who were writing that scene going into college, right? And the thing about that is, when you talk to big publishers or you talk to people who agents and this sort of thing, it is extremely hard to sell new adult to booksellers. So because Barnes & Noble just doesn't want to, this is how it's coming to me, this is how I'm hearing it, because Barnes & Noble doesn't know how to create a section for new adult, they refuse to sell new adult to people like Barnes & Noble. The books will be very obviously new adult books, meaning from age 18 to 25. Very obviously. We even have Allie Hazelwood. At this point, she would be considered new adult, especially with her first book, The Love Hypothesis. Like, she would be considered new adult. Their characters are doing adult, there's a nuance, there's a conversation that's not being had because people just will not create the shelf for those books. There's between 18 and 25, there are these years, I like to call them the folding years, where you don't know what you're doing, how you gonna do it, if you're gonna do it. And it's such an interesting period, especially when you don't have kids. It's such an interesting period because you're just worried about you and yourself. Right. And nobody likes to, as much as there might be writers that want to write about that period, the books that are selling and the way they're selling is by putting YA on them. So yep. The books can be very clearly for new adults. Like Sarah J. Maas, for example. Little Lady is not writing kid books. Those are not children's books. I don't care how old the kids are in the book. Those are very much adult actions going on. And why they having sex with fairies, I don't know. But that's what's happening. So there's so very obviously new adult books that are being labeled as YA.
Mm.
And that's mm-hmm. what's selling because that's what people are used to.
Mm-hmm.
But at some yeah. point, you have to create that new adult shelf.
Okay, here's my hot take on that. All Barnes & Noble needs to do is go to IKEA, buy a bookshelf, and slap new adult on there. It's like if you make a place for it, people are probably going to buy it. I could be wrong. I'm no publishing expert, but I am someone who buys books. And if there was a section called that, I would be intrigued because I like to think as someone who's in their 20s, I fall into that category. And the other thing is when a lot of these like young adult books that where they take place in high school and they're solving all these mysteries, I'm thinking, where do they have the time? They are in school. In college, you're still busy, but you may have a whole Tuesday in a semester where Tuesday and Thursday you have no classes. They can solve they can solve the murder Tuesdays and Thursdays that week. And so
where are your parents? Like,
that right. too.
They care about you. Where do mamas and daddies be? Where people be sleeping over at the house and sneaking in the back window? They didn't hear that. Like I be so befuddled. I don't. And I, you know, it's crazy to be an adult now and go back and try to read YA. It's super hard. I tried to go back and read The Selection. I don't know if y'all remember The Selection because I never read it in school. Or I never read it when I was a teenager. But I went back to read The Selection, and I was just like, God. I can't get through this. Just the thought process, period, of being a teenager and like having to go through this very dramatic torture and like even thinking about the Hunger Games, like I've never actually read the Hunger Games, but like I think there's something to say about style and technique and delivery with those kind of books mm-hmm. where like you gotta set it in a certain kind of place. It has to be in a certain kind of setting for it to be even believable. I don't know, something about that the difference between books like The Selection or, I don't know if y'all probably never read this book because I think it was just a Scholastic book, but it was a book called Crazy. And it was about a kid that like, who basically was raising himself. His dad was like an alcoholic or something. And he was going to school every day, like everything was normal. But when he was at home, he had all these like people living with him. And come to find out he had, schizophrenia, and he was just kind of like living on his own with his dad, kind of taking care of his dad, paying the bills with schizophrenia. And it's such a genius book, but there's something to say about the difference between realistic settings for YA books and consequences and situations versus just very Wattpad-ish storylines that allow the kids to just be. Something to say about that, something weird about that. I don't understand it. I don't even know how we got there. Mm-hmm. And yeah. It goes back to kind of something Infinity said about it basically being pedophilish. Pedophilish? Like, what's the word for that?
Pedophilic.
Right. Pedophilic, yeah.
Yeah, there's something to say about that too. That as adults, especially most of the time, the writers are women that are writing these YA books that are heavy sexual. There's a conversation to have about, because there is that conversation about romance and women and how they write romance and why they write romance the way they write it. Why do writers, women and men, write these YA books that are so very heavily sexual? Are we trying to relate to the realistic setting, or is there something else going on that we haven't fulfilled or something that's not being fulfilled? I'm just going to stop it there because I don't got no questions on that. It's not my business. But there's something to ask.
Okay. Any other hot takes?
I can say this last one. It's not that hot. Oh, I was just going to say, like, in terms of, like, sales and, like, measures of success, there should be different measures of success for, like, ebook/audiobook sales versus, like, print sales. I kind of feel the same way about music as well. Like, you can't really judge like records and like Spotify streams. Like, I don't think those two are one and the same. So I kind of feel like there should be a different measure of success based on that. Now, I don't know if there's any like prominent authors that are solely on just like ebooks, audiobooks. But what do y'all think about that?
I was thinking about Amazon specifically. And when we were just falling back a little bit, getting to the last one. Amazon is a place where a lot of different genres are accessible and a lot of different emerging writers are accessible. And they are mostly, I'm pretty sure they're mostly at this point measured off of ebooks. You know, they do have print books, but most of them, because of the way Amazon sells, sometimes they have days where they just sell the books are free. Just get one, just pick it, put it in your Kindle. And because it's such easy access directly from your Kindle, those ebook sales obviously are very high. And of course, we talked about this in the last episode that, you know, we are in the era where people who grew up reading off of ebooks or reading offline have access and have money. Or, you know, those things are accessible to them. So when it comes to ebook sales specifically, I think that it's fair to be like, let's measure this separately and let's focus on this separately. Print sales, because of the way times have changed, there's a chance that print sales will be very low, you know? But that I think that just goes back to accessibility and time. And I think that's something COVID revealed to us, was like how we deal with time, how we deal with work, how we, where we put our time, and how do we relax and that sort of thing. I remember, y'all remember AWP conferences?
Mm-hmm.
I remember I finally got to the AWP conference, and something that was brought up during one of the talks was the sales had just skyrocketed for all around, for ebooks, for print, for audio. It just skyrocketed in the middle of COVID because people didn't have to go to work. You know, you could just sit in your house and chill out and listen to audiobook the whole time. And I think that is interesting to have, see how that effect tunnels away, or what changes after with quotation marks, COVID. To see how all those sales change and shift. And because now people's living situations are different. How they choose to live, how they choose to go to work, how they choose to exist is changing. So that'll be interesting to just see how those sales change over time, whether print really sticks, and whether print sticks forever, whether it will suddenly become like a novelty kind of situation. Which would be really messed up. That'd be really messed up. But that'd be interesting to see.
I agree. That will be interesting because I know we like go through waves of like trends and niches where like at one point it's cool to, you know, like have the physical book in your hand and stuff like that. Kind of like with how vinyl records have become popular again.
Yeah.
That's why I feel like we're kind of like going in that direction with print books, because I know a lot of people love, you know, going to like Barnes and Nobles and Books a Million or whatever and getting those actual physical copies and just reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And compared to people who, because for me, I am a physical reader. I do not like ebooks or like Kindles or like reading online, because my attention in a screen is shorter than it would be with a physical book. So it is interesting to see, or to see how we'll go in the future.
It's funny that this is a hot take, because when I was in my master's program, my professional project was actually on preference selection in print media versus electronic media. And when I did my focus groups, the one comment was really interesting to me, because, you know, we spend like at work, we're on our computer all day. And back in the day, we'd be at school, we'd be at work, our heads would be in books, we'd be using pen and paper, we'd come home, we would get on the computer, watch funny videos, play a game or whatever. And now everything at work is so technological, and like computers and our phones and everything, that the comment that someone made was they thought like the pendulum would swing the other way, whereas we'd come home, we would want to have more print media versus digital. Mm-hmm. And which some people disagreed with that because like electronics are here to stay. And but at the same time, I think, you know, I do look at a screen all day when I'm at work because I work on a computer. Why would I want to come home and look at a screen more, given I do spend a lot of time on my phone? But her kind of prediction was, the question she asked was, I wonder if it'll start to swing the other way where people come home and they want to pick up a book or they want to read a physical newspaper or a magazine versus getting on their computer or scrolling on their phone, because I don't know, it's just times have changed so much since then, especially for us, I think, because I mean, we didn't do school via computer when we were in elementary school. Those things weren't really introduced until we were probably, or like electronics in the education system besides like the computers in the school library really weren't being introduced until we were in high school. Mm-hmm. So, and now it's just a serious part of the curriculum. Just when my mom retired. So it would be interesting to see, because I love a paperback book or hardback. I want to be able to hold it in my hand. I get the convenience of a Kindle or a Nook, but I don't know, just for me personally, I like the physical copy in my hand versus an ebook.
I think when it comes to me, I don't know anymore whether I would like the print. I've had a Kindle before, and I think I was blowing my mind on that Kindle. My dad called me and was like, Marissa, have you bought 6 books? Like, please take my card off that thing. but I don't know if I like would need print anymore, but that is a matter of like how much time I have and how much attention I can give to a book. Like, I talked about this in the last episode too, but I am an audiobook girly, and mostly because I just grew up not easily being able to access a book as soon as I wanted to read it, and it was easier to find it online to listen to. And so it's something that I appreciate. I think there's something to deeply appreciate about having the book and having, you know, the notes on the side of the page and highlighting your favorite parts and having it immediately. I love that, but I also respect having that Kindle, and I also respect having the audio. For people who have no time to pick up that book and annotate it the way they want to. So I think all of them have their place, and they all should be viewed as just another way to experience a book, because I think they all give you different experiences, especially when you're talking about audio versus like you physically reading a book. Not every narrator is going to be great. I'm just going to say that. Audiobook narrators, some of them be questionable. Not all of them are going to be great, but you do get a totally different experience, and it's really dope. So I think all of it has its place, and it should be seen as seen and put in their proper places when experiencing them or going through them. No one should just be used all the time.
What are some of your hot takes, Kate?
One of my first ones, this was kind of funny. I just said that cliches are actually harder to write than, you know, like if you're trying to go like a non-traditional route. Mm-hmm. I think cliches are actually really hard to write than people realize.
Oh yeah, they are.
I think they can be too, because I feel like and maybe my take on this is not exactly right, but I feel like cliches can be hard to write because you have to make them realistic in a sense,
right?
And they're just not, they're cliches for a reason.
Right.
And so, I mean, don't get me wrong, like sometimes a story idea can come from a cliche, but I just would not recommend trying to use it, because you might write yourself into a corner that you can't get out of.
Right. And what people think cliches may not be, what might be cliche to you might not actually be a cliche, mm-hmm. you know, to everyone.
Yeah. Excellent point.
And I think the other one I had, honestly, I don't even think mine's an unpopular opinion since everybody agrees with them. I think not all writers are book lovers.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, I think a lot of writers actually hate reading. That's not me. I mean, I love reading, but I know a lot of people that do not like reading books but can write their heart out, you know.
Oh, that can sometimes be me, low key.
That's so interesting, because I feel like when I was getting my bachelor's degree, one of the, like, it was highly encouraged in order to write more, to like learn how to write, was to read more, uh-huh. and everything. And so I never thought about it that way. But yeah, I guess because maybe they just want to stick to their own style and they don't maybe want to be influenced by another writer. I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I have heard that. I know, I forgot who it was that I was taught reading in, when I was in graduate school. I know this one person, this one writer, he would, like, go to, like, this secluded cabin or whatever and, like, write his books. Uh-huh. And, like, so he wouldn't be influenced by anyone else or whatever. Like, those writer retreats that people get to go on. Yeah. He would like that, so he wouldn't be, like, you know, influenced by something else. So...
I've kind of always wanted to do one of those writer's retreats, because I feel like sometimes if you write in your daily life, it can get really distracting, but I don't know.
Yeah, and emotions change a lot.
That too.
Yeah.
I can say I'm one of those writers that at least I don't read a particular genre because I like the way I write it. So, like, I don't read nonfiction. I like the way I write my nonfiction. I do not want anybody else's way of writing nonfiction to influence how I write my nonfiction. When it comes to fiction... I want more understanding, because it goes back to what you said, what your point about cliches. What other people think cliche, what is cliche, might not be cliche to, you know, to me, and it might not be cliche to the readers that I attract. And so I like to go through fiction and kind of just like, especially because so many subgenres within fiction are made up of those cliches. People will not consider your book romance if it does not have this sex scene and this and this, right? Like, they're just things that make a YA book in fiction. So that ends up being something that, like, I think I end up really feeling the need to have reference points for. But nonfiction is so very personal. And it's something I feel like only you can tell your story the way you need to tell it. Even if what you're saying isn't completely right or completely, not even the word truth, I only use the word truth. It's your truth. But it might not be right. Your information, what you understand about a situation that you're writing about, might not be the complete truth to somebody else, right? And that's the interesting thing about nonfiction. It's completely from your perspective. So I don't ever really think it's, I don't really trip about reading nonfiction from other people. But in terms of cliches, I did think of this. I love cliches.
Me too.
Can I write them much? I don't know. But I love them. And I love them, especially when I think about Korean dramas, because Korean drama writers are really great at taking, especially the romance cliches and the romance tropes, and they're good at flipping those molds and making you go like, oh my God, like, how do we get here? And I always think about, when I think about cliches, I always think about this one particular show called Jealousy Incarnate. And it's a love triangle drama, but it's like, I don't know, at some point, by the time you get to the point where everybody realizes the triangle is, first of all, the acknowledgement of the triangle, like, it's such a interesting thing. Usually for some reason, the triangle is acknowledged but in very subtle ways a lot of times in stories. This triangle is so very acknowledged that the triangle, the people in the triangle decide to live together and date each other all at once. So, like, I just remember watching that for the first time and being so befuddled and confused, and still allowing that main character or the person that's like the center of that triangle to pick a person, just pick one person. I remember watching that and being like, that was such a strong cliche, but they did such a great twist on it, and they introduced a lot of different perspectives for it. And I think that's the cool thing about it. It's kind of like having rules that you can break. There's a standard, but you can always break them up, slice it, dice it, however you want to. So cliches are dope. I think they're really dope.
Yeah, I like them when they're done right and they like make sense to the story.
Yeah.
Are there any other hot takes that we want to kind of spitfire before we finish our episode?
I don't even want to say mine now. I'm like, dang, what? Everybody else? I don't even remember what mine were. I think one of them was, very specific to publishing. I said this, people will hear this in a later episode, but I use the word selfish when describing the publishing industry. And I kind of want to go back on what I said, not go back on what I said, but kind of elaborate on what I thought. I think publishing can be very preferential, but I think that's fair. Publishing is one of those things that, like, when we're talking about new adult books, for example, and whether they should have a space on the bookshelves, that's something that publishing kind of decides on its own based off of what books they decide to pick up, period. Like, whether they decide to ever buy any new adult books, and whether they ever decide to promote those as new adult books. That's very much about what they think, how they feel about it. When it comes to agenting itself and picking a book is very much about what that agent feels like reading at that point in their life. So there will be plenty of times where you as a reader, you want to read another dystopian book like The Hunger Games, but because nobody else is writing a ton of them and it's not getting the attention of a bunch of agents, you won't see those books for another 10 years. And you just kind of have to be okay with that. Publishing is very preferential. And then I forgot what my other one was. And I don't know how y'all feel about that. Like, I always think about this. I always say that about publishing, but I never asked you guys, like, how y'all feel about, in terms of writing your own work and preparing it to go to agents and preparing it to go to publishers, how y'all feel about that idea of it being very, like, lottery system. I don't know if that freaks y'all out or what. It freaks me out.
I would agree. I think, not to get all like conspiracy theorists here, but I kind of am interested on like who's controlling the narrative, who's controlling what stories, what media is allowed to be consumed. And I kind of had this thought originally when we were talking about like the YA types of books. Mm-hmm. But as far as concerns, I don't think I have any. I think that I'm a firm believer in like right place, right time, and like things always working out. So even if it doesn't work out for a specific publishing agent, then it might work out for someone else. Or, I mean, you can just self-publish, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah. There's different
ways to do it nowadays. Whereas a couple of years ago, I don't think we had access, or there wasn't as many avenues to be able to publish aside from going like directly through a publisher. So now we have more, a publisher, sorry. Now we have more, you know, options to choose from.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Anybody else? Like, I don't know, like, because I have to just think about, I had a classmate ask, so funny, she directly asked the agent, do you think that writers of color are just a part of the trend right now when it comes to books being published? And their agent was kind of like, well, no, I think because the publishing scene is changing a bit, like, writers of color it's not going to be a trend. They're setting a pace for there to be more books of color being published. But that's still, like, if you look, I don't know Affinity, if you remember this, but like looking for agents of color, just agents of color, forget editors, like agents of color, y'all, that is difficult. It's extremely difficult when you look at that list of agents and all these different agencies, mm-hmm. Majority of them are white.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, you have to go in kind of hoping and praying that, first of all, they're Gen Z or Zillennials at least, because they're going to have a new, not necessarily a new take, but they're going to be attempting to get different sorts of books. And that's just, they're going to attempt to, but that doesn't mean they're always going to pick up your book. So I think for me, that is kind of weird, but I didn't know how y'all felt about that. It's very preferential industry. And then plot-to-plot stories was my other thing. Right now, I think my biggest thing with Amazon books specifically is that a lot of those books are plot-to-plot books, and they influence a lot of books up. And we kind of got into this in the last episode. There's a lot of stuff we got into in the last episode. But we got into this a little bit in the last episode about how those different Amazon books basically, how they become redundant, or they're the same, they're promoted constantly, and there's never a switch out or a change of books, and those books can be popular for years and years and years. But I think
that also falls into something we talked about earlier, which is style and the transition in the literary canon. And it kind of, I don't know, have y'all read Normal People by, you know what I'm talking about? The author, it's a Hulu show, Normal People, Conversations with Friends, is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. I forgot the writer's name, but she's very popular. She's Scottish, and her books turn into Hulu shows, and she writes a lot like the workshop. She kind of writes like, it's kind of, when you read her stuff, it's like reading somebody in workshop. But she, I can see her becoming a part of like the college literary canon. People bring her into the workshop just to like, you know, talk about her style. I feel like she might just be a part of like the transition into plot to plot writing. And I don't know how y'all feel about that. Like, how you feel about the changing of style and the change, because I feel like it changes the purpose of a story, or it changes the purpose of books when you write like that, and that becomes the popular way of writing.
Well, I mean, I think plot to plot, I think part of it's just attention spans. I think everyone just kind of wants to get to the point of the story more. That's my take on that. I think that's why there are more plot to plot and there's not as much world building or detail and fleshing out, you know, the story more. I think that's why there's more plot to plot.
I wondered if y'all thought there was a danger in that. Like, will they always just be, like, will it settle? Like, will it always just, like, be, have its proper place? Or do you think it'll come into, not just, it's already pretty commercial. It's pretty commercial, but will it influence even those books that are very much about world building and this sort of thing? And I asked that thinking about books like Fourth Wing. I don't know if y'all read Fourth Wing. A lot of books.
I haven't, but it's on my list.
It is.
It's on my list to read. But honestly, I'm a contrarian and I really don't like reading books that are like popular through TikTok and stuff. Like, I never read, like, I think the only Pauline Hoover book I've read was Verity.
Oh, I hadn't read that one.
Yeah, I haven't read any of her other books because they're just like, blah. But that's on my list for me. It's on my list. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. I didn't feel cut off. But that was kind of, those are my hot takes. It's just kind of thinking about how preferential publishing is and plot to plot writing, because that kind of scares me. It kind of makes me feel like by the time I get to publish a book, or just like I'm like, all right, now I'm ready to publish and ready to send to agent, whether they'll even have the attention span to read however I write, because I know I'm not a plot to plot writer. So just something I think about in terms of the future and like how I might go about my career.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it goes back to what Susan was saying about popularity and what's in right now and what's not in right now. And I feel like because of social media, something is like sticking with writers and things. Mm-hmm. And that style of writing is just, I feel like it's more popular right now.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What's the other one? Not Fourth Wing, but it's another book that everybody has been telling me to read. And it has a lot of world building in it. What is it? Something about thorns and roses or something like that?
Oh, Court of Thorns and Roses.
In the book, Sarah J. Maas?
Yes.
Yeah, Court of Thorns and Roses. Yeah, that book. Isn't that book like a lot of world building too, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes.
I would like to think so.
I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, so. I read it a few years ago before. Like, I mean, it was popular then, but it's really picked up in popularity now.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a lot of world building in that book for sure.
Yeah, and I blame TikTok. Like, all of these books are, like, there's whole sections now in Barnes and Noble's of called TikTok books.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, I'm not a fan of it.
I'm cautious. I'm really cautious about all of it because I think I tried to read a couple books that were popular on TikTok, but each time I would try to, like,
get into them. I don't know, something about them that just made me feel like something was missing, or like, and you want to be like, it's kind of what Susan was saying earlier, you want to be like, well, I'm just not into that right now, like, but you picked it up because you were interested in the whole concept, but something's just not given, like, I hate to say it like that, but it's not given what it's supposed to be given, like,
yeah,
and you kind of just put it down, and you're looking at them like, I can't trust y'all, like, I cannot trust your recommendations, I'm stressed out. That's where I am at this point, and I'm having to, like, backtrack and, like, backpedal and find books that I just kind of, like, skipped over when I was in high school that I just didn't pay much attention to, and then kind of, too, at the same time, fall into books that are considered, you know, kind of thinking about One Summer in Savannah. Like, I finished One Summer in Savannah, but I felt funny about it by the end of it, and I was just going to save it for, like, if we ever do a book club episode, I was just going to save it for then. But I felt kind of funny about it. So it's kind of interesting trying to, like, I think it all just kind of goes back to the Reading Slumps episode, too, where you're just trying to find your footing.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like a lot of these books that are being, like, popular because of TikTok, they all have kind of have, like, that same premise of, like you said, new adult. It's fantasy or, like, a dystopian world. And that's just, apparently, that's just what, and I feel like it's people that's our age that did read, like, you know, like, Twilight, Hunger Games, Maze Runner. And now that we're, you know, like, coming into adults, that's what we're reading now. And it's kind of just, like, what we're attracted to, I feel like.
Well, I don't have any additional comments on anything. But yeah, this was just our take on hot takes, I guess.
We might do another episode of this, because I think, and we'll probably get better at it, because I think it's kind of so much to process and so many random things, but the point of the episode is just to, like, you know, get to know us better. So hopefully people got to know us, got to know how we think, got used to our voices, couldn't recognize our voices because we showed it, introduced ourselves in the beginning. But hopefully you guys got used to our voices and kind of can get an idea of how the rest of the season goes. So we hope you enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, fellow writers, it's Kate. Thanks for listening. We really hope you enjoyed today's episode of The Unwritten. You got comments? Looking for advice? Hit us up on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Journey Writer. We love to hear from you. Catch you on the next episode. Bye. Hey, fellow writers, it's Kate. Thanks for listening. We really hope you enjoyed today's episode of The Unwritten. You got comments? Looking for advice? Hit us up on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Journey Writer. We love to hear from you. Catch you on the next episode. Bye.